A Radiance in the Gulag by Nyola Sedolita. Chapter 8. To the Labor Camp. After the court's decision, the prison's Black Raven, the prison vehicle sheeted in black iron, returned me to the KGB cellars, but this time very briefly, for just a couple days. The day after the trial, they granted me a brief visit with my brother, Jonas Sodonis. Before the visit, a soldier herded me into a cell in solitary, where a female KGB medical aide stripped me and searched everything in detail. I was subject to the same medical procedure after the visits also. My brother had brought me a dark red rose, which my KGB guards examined for a long time, looking over each leaf to see whether anything was hidden there. During the visit, they seated me and my brother carefully. We were separated by a glass partition and wide table. And the prison guard did not take his eyes off us the whole time, constantly interrupting our conversation, demanding that we speak only of meaningless everyday topics. Otherwise, he threatened to cut the visit short. After our visit, my brother wished to give me food and clothing for the journey to the Mordova concentration camp, but they would not take anything from him. The Czechists told him to bring them back the next day, and then they told him that I had already been taken away, even though this was a deliberate lie, for they took me away a day later. This is a standard torture. Let them be hungry on the way. Before taking me off the concentration camp, on June 20th, 1975, the same KGB female paramedic searched me in solitary confinement, while the soldiers searched my meager food and clothing reserves. They even tore the wrappers from the candy and seized all of my notes, afterward having warned me, "Saying goodbye to Lithuania, you'll never see it again. You're in our hands and we'll do what we want with you." They took me in a raven to the Lukiskiai prison in Vilnius. There they shut me up in a concrete cubicle, a solitary confinement cell, where one can only sit surrounded by walls and facing the door. After sitting for a while, you begin to suffocate for lack of air, but this does not bother anyone. "You didn't come to a resort," the guards taunt you. After keeping me in that cubicle for several hours, the soldiers herded me into a raven already packed with criminal offenders. To isolate me from them, they pushed me into the raven's iron cubicle, a solitary confinement compartment like a steel coffin, and drove us all to the Vilnius railroad station. The raven is windowless. You see nothing, as if you are buried alive. In the Soviet Empire, a prisoner is not a person. He is treated somewhat worse than a beast. He is a slave without rights, despised, morally and physically abused nonstop by guards and soldiers. After bringing us to the Vilnius railroad station, soldiers with dogs ordered us all off the Raven. Off on a siding, out of public view, the prisoner's railroad car awaited us. Lining us up, they positioned me first as an especially dangerous state criminal, the Soviet term for prisoners of conscience, with four soldiers and two guards watching me. All the others, several score of male criminals, they lined up behind me and guarded them with just a few soldiers and a couple of dogs. The prisoners were surprised, and they asked where they had been keeping me, since I was so pale and exhausted, although they themselves did not look any better. After 10 months of living in the KGB underground prison, I saw again that the trees and grass were still green, that there was so much space about, and the sky was so big, not at all like what I had seen through the little barred window. What a joy to see all that. Thanks to the Creator for such beauty. Only there was no time for us to enjoy it at all, because they quickly herded us into a railroad car. In the prisoner's car, behind thick steel bars, are separate cubicles with steel-barred doors fastened with a large lock. They locked me up alone in a cubicle made to accommodate two, while the male criminals were stuffed 8 or even 12 to a four-place cubicle. At night, a wooden bench took the place of a bed. I was able to lie down on the bench, but the male prisoners, packed like herring in a barrel, had no room to lie down or even to sit. In the corridor in front of our pens paced three military guards. Before my pen, a soldier stood constantly with a rifle, never taking his eyes off me, lest I evaporate. The guard was changed every 3 hours. The prisoners asked them what I had done to be guarded so. They, most of whom were 4 to 6 time repeaters, had never seen anyone guarded so closely. They were surprised to learn that in the Soviet Empire there are still prisoners of conscience, and all of them cursed the Soviet government, which, according to them, was alone responsible for their being dehumanized. Soldiers shouted back at us not to talk, that it was not allowed, but later even they got interested in the conversation. In the hearts of most of them there still flickered a spark of humanity, but it was covered over with hatred and the ashes of various kinds of evil, the results of atheistic upbringing. On the trip, the prisoner is given one small loaf of black bread a day, very sour and underbaked. They used to give us such bread in the KGB cellars and in the concentration camp. Also, this bread is specially baked for prisoners. And after eating which, the stomach begins to ache as though fire were burning, and a few small, soggy, and very salty little fish, herring the size of a finger. I used to refuse this ration, and would not eat it in order to avoid agony later, although when I was free I had been able to eat everything, and never experienced stomach trouble. I had been quite healthy. Prisoners who ate the little herring would ask for water to quench their thirst, but the soldiers would make fun of them, and purposely not give them anything to drink for hours on end, saying, "Let them suffer." In the car, such an uproar and such cursing would begin that it was sheer hell. When they'd finally had their fun, the soldiers would bring a kettle of water, and after drinking it, the prisoners would soon begin to ask to be allowed to go to the toilet, and once more the soldiers would torment the prisoners, purposely not taking them for several hours. How much cruelty there is in the hearts of young soldiers, 18 to 20 years old, almost all of them wore communist youth badges, Lenin's grandchildren. They curse and swear as much as the worst criminals. So much for communist morality. Some time after we had left Vilnius, we stopped, and our car remained at the siding for a whole day. No one gave us any food rations for the following day because it had not been foreseen that the journey to the prison to Pilskov would take 2 days. The prisoners, weakened as they were, had to fast. After I pleaded with them for a long while, the soldiers agreed to distribute to the prisoners what I still had in the way of food, but it was nearly a drop in an ocean. The transport is a special way of tormenting prisoners. The journey is specially drawn out to a month, or even two, when normally 2 or 3 days would be enough. The prisoners' cars are overcrowded. All of the prisoners almost ceaselessly smoke the worst grade of tobacco, Makhrolda, and the windows in the corridor of the car are not open during the day. The glass is opaque so that people cannot see the pale prisoners being transported behind the bars, but the car is so full of blue smoke that you cannot see anything a few paces away. Anyone unaccustomed to smoking becomes dizzy as though poisoned. At night it is cold because they open little windows. Most of the prisoners are very lightly dressed, and the nights are often damp and cold, even during the summer, to say nothing of winter. Male political prisoners are transported in the same pen with criminals, who ridicule them, take away everything, and moreover beat them up. The soldiers just incite them and laugh, since prisoners of conscience are called fascists by the Soviets. Such a one should be beaten. Criminal prisoners have sunk to such depths of immorality that they, being in the same car with them, you feel the greatest moral suffering, to say nothing about those whose lot it is to be with them in the concentration camps. This has lately become, in the Soviet Union, a daily occurrence. The Czechists now warn everyone, "We'll lock you up together with the criminals," or "We'll shut you up in the psychiatric hospital," or "We'll hire murderers and they'll kill you tonight, and so there'll be no trace of you left." On the way to the female political prisoner's strict regime concentration camp of Mordova, I stayed 4 to 6 days in the jails of Pulskov, Yaroslavl, Garkozik, Rukyov, and Potma, at transfer points, when, after a few days of travel, the soldiers would shove us out of the car, often kicking the weaker ones, and herd us into the Raven, which would take us to the jail. The Raven, covered in black sheet iron, heated by the sun and stuffed with prisoners, would be hot as a furnace. People were suffocating. The thirst was agonizing. The limbs began to grow numb, for we were packed almost on top of one another, unable to move. In a cubicle intended for one, they would lock me up with another female, and we would suffer together. The jails were also overcrowded. The cells held more than the allotted number of prisoners, hence it was necessary to wait and suffer almost half a day in the Raven until they would free a cell for the new arrivals. They would let us out of the Raven and into a common cell, for which, after a long delay, they summoned us, according to the paragraphs of the criminal code under which we'd been sentenced, searched us, and assigned us to cells. The jail cells are dismal, dirty, often full of a wide variety of parasites, be it bedbugs, fleas, lice, roaches. And in the little yard they would take us a half-hour a day for exercise, there were also rats. In the cells it is cold and damp, for no ray of sun gets in. In the windows are several rows of rusty bars. What is more, a perforated sheet of iron not only keeps the light getting in, but even the air. Hence, in the cells, the light burns day and night. At Pskov, they shut me up for a whole week in the jail's basement, in solitary. The ceiling of the cell was low and the walls damp, but the concrete floor, to which a rusty iron bed without a mattress was fastened. Ushering me in, they issued an old, dirty, ragged blanket. Right in the cell was a hole in the floor for a toilet. The little window was sealed with sheet iron, and the light burned all the time. In the concentration camps and prisons, they feed you enough to keep you from starving. In the morning, in an iron bowl, are a few spoons of porridge, cooked from the lowest grade of groats, without any fat, and a cup of muddy water, tea. For lunch, a dipper of a thin concoction called walonda, and again a few spoons of porridge, over which they pour some malodorous fat, or they give you a little piece of fish, from which the prisoners often get food poisoning. I too suffered food poisoning many times from that fare. In the evening, once again, a few spoons of groats and tea. They also give you half a little loaf of bread each day, which, on account of its poor quality, I could not eat. For eating, they pass a konrushka through the opening of the door. It is strictly forbidden to speak to the prisoners distributing food. Often standing next to them are soldiers. All the prisoners are thin skeletons covered with pale, bluish skin, and they often joke, "As long as the bones survive, the flesh will grow back." When they took us from the jail, there would be another search, and again the raven, the station, the iron bars, and the railroad car. In my compartment now, they would pack other female prisoners, and the journey continued. Besides Pskov, we were temporarily incarcerated in the jails of Yaroslavl, Gorkil, Rugyayev, and Potma, where they would shut me up in the same cell with female criminals, including murderesses. There were many female prisoners. I was with young 15-year-old offenders sentenced for robbery and murder, with pregnant women, mature women, and those who were quite old. I was amazed at the terrible immorality on the part of all of them, the complete loss of discernment between good and evil, the dehumanization. Here you see what a poor creature man is without God, and that the greatest offenders of all are those who systematically, forcibly, and constantly infect everyone with the atheistic lie, the Soviet government atheists. Those millions of poor dehumanized prisoners are the fruit of their education. Finally, they brought me to the last jail in Potma, where they shut me up with female prisoners in a large cell. Instead of beds, as in the Gorkil jail, we slept on slightly raised wooden pallets. We were attacked by bedbugs in such numbers that we began protesting. The guards told us that there were no bedbugs in the cell, and then we caught a few of them, and, writing a protest to the warden, we included the bedbugs as evidence. After a half day, they took us to another cell, where there were fewer parasites. In the prison yard and toilets, light brown rats roamed impudently. Until then, I'd only seen gray rats. After a few days, they herded us all into a train, but they did not put me in the same car with the female criminals. They told us they had to transport specially dangerous state criminals, namely me, in a separate compartment under special guard. They shut me up alone in a double compartment. The Potma prison guards were surprised that I did not know how to curse or swear. "Where did you come from?" they asked. "By the time they transport you from camp to exile, you have learned everything." To their great surprise, their prophecy was not fulfilled. During my transport from camp to exile, I came to meet some of the guards again. I finally reached my last transfer point. They shut me up in a separate cubicle in the railroad car and took me away. From Potma, a narrow gauge train transported the prisoners through swampy forests. Along the whole route, the only thing we could see through the little open windows were barbed wire enclosures, concentration camps. Soldiers, guards, and dogs, one after the other, more than 20 concentration camps in which were crowded a whole Soviet republic of slaves. The hard labor concentration camp for female political prisoners is reached after passing all the other concentration camps strung out along the railroad line, which carries prisoners almost exclusively. For this reason, they did not even close the little windows here. We had arrived in a slave state. Finally, we were at the last stop, and they ordered us out. They sent various individuals to various places. I was herded into the reception room of the women's concentration camp, where I was searched. They took my copy of the court's decision for verification, and they never returned it, even though I appealed to the concentration camp commandant many times in writing, asking him to return it. Soviet officials do not like to leave the decisions of their criminal trials with political prisoners, and they seize them for almost everyone as soon as after the trial or after transportation to camp. After the search, they put my clothing in storage and clothed me in prison garb. The journey from Vilnius to Mordovia had taken a whole month. During the long and exhausting trip to Mordovia, Niola lost 33 pounds. Camp food is very monotonous and of poor quality, barely mashed without any fat, fish, leftover scraps of meat, cow udder, diaphragm, lungs. In the fall, cabbage soup is served for several months, but when the cabbage supply runs out, another kind of soup is made of several months, and always has the same soup. Niola fell ill on October 10, 1975, suffering from fever and dizziness throughout the winter and so on into the spring of 1976. She was ill again the following winter. The female prisoners greeted us with love and concern, and one Ukrainian prisoner gave me a pleasant surprise by laying out before my plate little flowers arranged in the form of the tricolor of independent Lithuania. The women's concentration camp zone was small, a tiny triangular yard surrounded by a double fence of barbed wire and a third high fence of wood, so that one might not see anything. On top of this was a guardhouse. It was strictly forbidden for the prisoners to speak with guards. In the center of the yard was a little old wooden house, or barrack, in which one room served as a dormitory, another as a dining hall, and next to it was a workroom, where each prisoner was required to sew 60 pairs of work gloves a day. Anyone failing to fill her quota was taken to the punishment cell. Sewing machines were ancient and would often break down. The thread was of poor quality and would snap every few minutes. Sheer torture. I used to sew my quota from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., with brief breaks for eating, exercise, and prayer. Yola's sufferings and strength of character are described more thoroughly in a letter written by her during this time. Quote, "And how good it is that the small boat of our life is steered by the hand of a good father. When he is at the wheel, nothing is frightening. Then, no matter how hard life becomes, you will know how to fight and how to love. And I can say that in the year 1975 has flown by with a wink of an eye, but it has been my joy. I thank the good God for it." On March 3rd, I returned from the hospital. At last, it looks as though I will be up and about. Your diagnosis was quite accurate. Acute exhaustion. My vacation lasted some time. I started it on October 18th, 1975, and worked only 6 days in November, spent December in the hospital, and only at the end of the month was I able to sew for 4 days. January, I divided in half. One half I worked, the other half I did not. February was spent in the hospital, so for the first 3 days of March. Now I sew slowly, with pauses. When I feel weak, I go outside into the yard and enjoy the fresh air and the sun. I fulfill my quota because we work only for one shift, so for the time being, everything is going splendidly. Everyone loves me, and I try to respond in kind. I am happy and satisfied. Taken from the Chronicle of the Catholic Church of Lithuania, number 23, June 13th, 1976. It was good that we worked a whole day, and there were not many of us. I would have been in the punishment cell constantly because it is impossible to make one's quota during a single shift, with the sewing machine constantly breaking down. The ceiling of the workroom was low, without any ventilators, so that the electric sewing machines would heat the place up. There was also a lot of dust, including dust from fiberglass, with which we used to pad the palms of the gloves so that they would not wear out so easily. The gloves were intended for handling bricks in construction and other work. Lately, they have raised the quota, and the prisoner is supposed to make 110 pairs a day. The Soviets are unmerciful to their slaves. Half of a prisoner's wages are deducted by the state to pay the salaries of the guards, the KGB agents, etc., and from the remaining half, they take charges for food. For 1 month in a hard labor camp, they take about 12 rubles. One can get the same idea of the quality of the food, especially considering that the kitchen crew, female criminals cooked for us, used to steal prisoners' food and share it with the female guards. They used to deduct for clothing, bedding, and so on. There was practically nothing left for the prisoner. If you filled your quota and had no demerits, you were allowed to buy 5 rubles worth of food, writing materials, or soap per month at the concentration camp store. There was almost no food at the store, except for stale cookies, cheap candy, old preserves, tea, and occasionally margarine, jam, oil, and smokes of mazorka. Throughout my term, only a few times was there any white bread. We were accompanied to the store by guards, and if there was money in our account, which we had earned, we were allowed to buy. Otherwise, we could not buy. Money sent by friends and relatives could not be used for purchases. Spending money had to be earned. Prisoners who refused to perform compulsory labor, sewing gloves or doing other work, were punished during the whole term in the concentration camp. 3 consecutive 15-day stretches in solitary, followed by 3 or 6 months in a punishment cell, with brief respites between stretches. They were released in normal quarters for about a week, and everything began all over again. And so it went until the end of one sentence. Utter invalids were excused from compulsory labor, but even those in sick bed were put to work assembling paper cartons. When they brought me to the Moldova concentration camp, there were 21 women prisoners confined there, and I became the 22nd. Repairs were being made, and that week they allowed us to sleep in the yard on benches. What a pleasure, when after a year in stuffy prison cellars, I could once more breathe fresh air and enjoy the starry sky. However, it only lasted a week, after which they herded us all into the low and narrow dormitory, where all of us had to sleep. I slept on the floor in the attic, until the bed became available downstairs. There it was a little easier to breathe, but oxygen was still in short supply because the windows were shut. It was too cold for the old prisoners, and the dormitory was not large, one bed next to another, with a narrow aisle down the center. Among the greatest physical sufferings were those concentration camp nights, when you longed for the morning to be able to run out into the yard and get some fresh air before work. Because of this stuffiness, many suffered from insomnia. Yet, by day, even the old were strictly forbidden to rest. Only patients were allowed to lie down during the day. For the rest, it was a punishable offense. Reflections from a letter written by Niola particularly portray her true character. Quote, I am grateful to those through whose efforts I find myself here. I learn much and experience much, and all of this has been useful. After all, good God knows best what I need. In 6 days, it will be half a year since they took me from Vilnius, but it all seems such a short time ago, as if it were yesterday, and everything remains before my eyes, my honor guard, sharers of my fate, of whom there were many. They were all criminals. I was the only political prisoner. The last farewell, look at my city, or rather the train station, and the whole romance of the journey, which is indescribable. It must be experienced in order to feel life, and to understand the necessity and the value of love. I have the possibility of living through this romance a second time, when they take me into exile, and you can only envy me for this, although that is not necessary. All this is not for people in your physical condition. Unquote. Taken from the Chronicle, number 23, June 13th, 1976.